Hello, and welcome to The Evil Within, a true crime podcast. Today, we will be discussing the case of Amy Carnevale, a 14-year-old girl who was brutally murdered by her ex-boyfriend Jamie Fuller. On the show today, we will be discussing some of the legality behind this case. We have special guest Rose, who is a prosecutor in Massachusetts, the state where this crime took place. She also has some in-depth knowledge about the town that this crime took place in as she grew up there. So, we will now start that interview. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the podcast, we have Rose. She is a prosecutor, and she's going to share some of her thoughts and feelings on this case. As you know, today we are talking about the Amy Carnevale case, and we've got some very insightful answers. The first question I have for you is, I know that you have been in the Beverly area. How would you describe the relevance of this case on Beverly, Massachusetts as a whole?
Well, I would say it's sort of, I would imagine, kind of time period specific. I think at the time, it was extremely impactful, you know, statistically. In terms of violent crime, I wouldn't say Beverly is necessarily all that high up on the list. I don't think any neighborhood can escape it. It happens everywhere. But by and large, Beverly doesn't rank high on the list of cities with homicides, especially a domestic violence related homicide. That is something you probably see more in a suburb like Beverly than gang related violence. The fact that she was a young woman, the fact that it was domestic violence related, and the fact that it happens in a city that doesn't have a significant amount of homicides per year, that alone is going to have a pretty big impact on the community. I think it also had a pretty big impact because of her age. Whenever a child is killed and at 14, you very much, you know, are still in that phase of life. That's going to have a really big impact on a community. And then domestic violence in its entirety leaves a lasting impact on communities, as it's just a very stark reminder how far domestic violence will go and dating violence will go. So I think it certainly had an impact, a substantial impact at the time. I would say now, you know, given parole and the reconsiderations of sentencing, it's going to come back around as sort of unearthing some of that impact on the community as well.
You mentioned domestic violence and relationship violence. How common would you say, at least in your personal experience, would you say that you've seen domestic violence or relationship violence turn into attempted murder or murder?
Intimate partner violence there's a scale to it, but it is, I would say, just as prevalent as any other kind of homicide. It is certainly a leading contender in homicide. You know, if you looked at any county in the Commonwealth and you looked at their concentration of homicides, you'd find, let's say you had a county that had a significant gang population, I think you'd probably find close to or as many domestic or intimate partner homicides. It certainly is more prevalent than we would like.
And with that, do you think that the fact that this was a domestic violence case and that there was signs before made it have even more of an impact because people feel like after the fact that maybe there could have been something to stop it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the sort of stark reminders, right, that I mentioned earlier about relationship and dating and intimate partner violence, is that, you know, everybody, hindsight is 20/20, right? Everybody looks back at what they wanted to excuse for a particular reason for at what they might have been able to do or intervene in earlier. And the reality of the situation is that it's a reminder. It's a somber reminder of just how quickly that kind of violence can escalate, and that you really never want to dismiss the small acts because they can snowball into much bigger and more violent acts. But I think it's very natural for people close to the victim to look back in hindsight and say, what could I have done differently, or when could I have intervened? I think a lot of times we've seen it where people have intervened and done things differently and the outcome has been there. But I also think, you know, we have a lot of situations where we intervene and this isn't the outcome. So that's really the lesson, unfortunately, that is learned the hard way in some of these cases.
And Jamie Fuller was 16 when he committed this murder. How often is it that these domestic violence cases, at least in your experience, are actually perpetrated by children on other children?
Well, I think youth dating violence has always been there. I can't say that we see this that concentration of murders at that age. I think that's an unusual statistic, not unheard of, but more unusual. That's a significant escalation in violence for his age, but it certainly does happen. I think there's a lot of factors that go into that for each individual case, but it certainly does happen. I don't think it's as often as we see it in adults.
And talking about Fuller's progression into violence, he has been reported to have been on steroids and alcohol. Is that a commonality where you see drug abuse and alcohol abuse in these cases, especially where domestic violence turns deadly?
Yeah, I think in any domestic, you know, there's a cycle of domestic violence and there's usually a trigger. You know, there's usually a reason that people come to domestic violence. A lot of times you'll see, for abusers, you'll see a history of violence in their own life. You'll see a traumatic upbringing. You'll see violence in their home. that they were used to, or some sort of traumatic cataclysmic event for a child, like losing a parent in and out of foster care or things like that. Those are a lot of triggers. Usually it's learned. I think a lot of times it's a learned behavior. It might've been something that they were around. There are certainly those outlier cases, of course, in all of these examples that we're using, there are those outlier cases where they don't come from a particularly traumatic background, but become abusers in that way. But I think by and large, in the cases that I've seen in the last 8 years, you know, the ones that I followed closely, there's usually some sort of, and I do a lot of domestic violence work. I think, you know, you usually, there's a reason. Substance use disorder, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, those things certainly can play a factor because they inhibit impulse, right? So any substance that inhibits impulse and interferes with that is only going to exacerbate what is already an underlying issue. So if someone has an abusive tendency and if someone is in that space, I think substances usually only, you know, exacerbate that problem in the relationship as I've seen it. But it's also, you know, the cutting, you know, on the other side of that, I often find that it's a reason why a lot of people stay in those relationships is because they can blame it on something. For the abuser, you would say, you know, it exacerbates what is already a problem. Alcohol doesn't cause domestic violence, doesn't cause a person to become violent necessarily. That person usually already has that underlying issue. But I find that substances usually exacerbate it or make it worse. The converse of that, or the other side of that coin, I should say, is that it also, I think a lot of times makes a victim more sympathetic to their abuser. You know, oh, well, when he's not drinking or when he's not using or when she isn't drinking or when she isn't using, then they're not violent. And the reality of it is it's probably still happening on some level, but it's not as violent. It might be more emotional control. It might be more emotional abuse. It might be financial abuse, but the physical violence may not be as bad, but that's a danger, right? Because it leads that person to excuse the behavior and stay and reject help, which is something that we see a lot. And that when they have something to blame it on or a substance to vilify, they don't blame it on the person. So I think that's also, they go hand in hand and exacerbating the problem for the abuser, but also giving it out to the victim who stays longer than maybe they should.
And with that, is that something that you've seen taken into consideration in cases, the background of a substance abuse disorder or history of trauma or family abuse? Have you seen that come into play in cases where it's almost used to justify what a defendant has done, at least by the defense?
There's two parts that I think oftentimes, you know, if you're at trial for a violent offense and the person was using alcohol, you know, a defense is certainly going to ask that to play a role, right? So we have, you know, two different kinds. We have general intent and specific intent crime. For a general intent crime, voluntary intoxication is not a defense. But for a specific intent crime, it's also not a defense if you're voluntarily intoxicating yourself. However, there is an instruction that goes to the jury about you can take into consideration someone's level of intoxication in forming an opinion as to whether or not they were able to form the specific intent. So the best example of that would be witness intimidation. Witness intimidation is a specific intent crime. A person has to specifically intend to intimidate, harass, or threaten a person to stop them from participating at any stage of criminal investigation. A lot of times you see that on scenes when a person takes the other person's phone so they can't call 911. That's oftentimes how you see witness intimidation charged and how it plays out. And you have to form that specific intent. Like, I'm taking your phone so that you cannot call for help, so that you cannot relay information of a criminal nature to the police. I'm thwarting that ability. And the voluntary intoxication isn't a defense to that, but the jury can consider it if it's present in the case. And if there's evidence of intoxication as to whether or not the person had the ability in their mind to form that specific intent. So you definitely see it play a role in trial work and at trial in cases, but you also see it a lot at sentencing. I certainly view it as there are very few cases where a person isn't getting out of custody at some point, right? There's a punitive aspect to sentencing. And then there's also a rehabilitation aspect of sentencing. They have to work together. So, you know, I always look at it like there's a punishment period, but then also this person is going back into the community at some point. You know, even if someone is found guilty of rape, they're going to do maybe 8 to 10 years in the state prison, and then they're going to get out because there are very few life felonies. And so what are we doing on probation to ensure this person's release back into the community is safe? And that's where we need to have mental health treatment, substance use disorder treatment. And you need to have it, by the way. I mean, you certainly need to have it while the person's incarcerated, and the state prisons do offer programming. When you see people come up for parole, the parole board's always looking to see what kind of programming the person has availed themselves of, because there is a lot of it. So you need, while a person is serving a sentence, it's important to have good programming in these facilities. But certainly I think when you, as a prosecutor, you should be taking it into account when someone's getting out of an incarcerative sentence, regardless of how long it is, whether it's 6 months in the House of Correction or 5 years in state prison, we should be structuring probation in such a way that it puts the person back into the community better than when they came. So we have in Massachusetts, we have it used to be called Certified Batterers. Now it's the Intimate Partner Violence Program. And it's very involved. It's 40 weeks long, and it deals with a lot of the triggers of people who commit intimate partner violence. And so it's those kinds of things where you see the defendant's historical, whether it was trauma, whether it was substance use disorder, or whatever it was. I think at sentencing, you see that play out quite a bit. And you see that becoming a factor for all sides. I mean, it should be a factor for all sides, the judge, the defense, and the prosecution.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. True crime is one of my passions. Doing the research and compiling these shows makes me really happy. However, looking into these cases can be incredibly taxing on my mental health. When I'm having a difficult mental health day, I like to take a break and talk with someone. A therapist is a great person to talk to. Therapy has helped me so much over the years, from giving me the confidence to be able to do this show to making me the best version of myself. However, finding a convenient, affordable therapist has always been difficult. BetterHelp is a completely online therapy service that takes the stress out of finding a therapist, making it easy to begin your journey to better health today. If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/TEW today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TEW, and start your mental health journey today. Now, back to our show. As we both know, Fuller was given a life sentence without the possibility of parole. And at the time, that was an available sentence for someone who was 16. And as of 2013, there was a Supreme Court ruling that said that if they're under 18, they can't receive life without the possibility of parole. They can receive life, but there has to be a possibility of parole. Do you think that in this case, that was justified, giving him the opportunity to have a potential for parole in the future?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's murder in the first degree is when that sentence is available, life without parole. So, you know, justified is an interesting term. The law is now what it is, and we're bound by that. So our opinion on its justification is a little bit doesn't matter because the Supreme Court has spoken. You know, they're on this side of the fence when you look at the crime. And I always think this is important. It's the possibility of parole, not the promise of parole. So that's a really important piece of this, because just because someone may be given the possibility of parole doesn't mean they deserve parole. And that's why we have the parole board as the gatekeeping function to determining that. Whether or not someone is justified in getting parole is a different inquiry. I think the thought behind the decision from the Supreme Court is probably, in terms of justification, it's hard to know where I fall on that. Because on the one hand, you know, and I've done a lot of juvenile crime, in the last violent crime, I think one of those types of cases, I think one of the issues is their brain is not fully developed. So one of the things that you see in a lot of the research that we're supplied with is impulse control and an inability to frontal lobe development and where impulse control falls in that. And I think the science is sound, and I think that that certainly exists. However, a brutal killing such as this, and I mean, this was a brutal killing. A brutal killing such as this really does require effort and intention. I mean, there was a reason he was convicted of murder in the first degree, which is deliberate premeditation or extreme atrocity or cruelty. And so a jury has spoken on that issue, that it was, you know, either done with deliberate premeditation or extreme atrocity or cruelty. And a killing that is that brutal, it's hard to imagine a society where we want to agree that a person should be released back into the community, right? When you've committed an act so egregious. There really is little else as egregious as a first degree murder. But, you know, we balance that against, has the person been rehabilitated? Have they availed themselves of all of the programming? Have they stayed out of trouble? Have they had any disciplinary reports? Have they availed themselves of every program possible to deal with violence? Are they taking responsibility? You know, a lot of this, and you see it play out in parole hearings for domestic violence homicides, a lot of us are looking to see, can they take responsibility? Because usually someone committing intimate partner violence, it's about control. And so they don't want to take responsibility. There's always a, well, they did this. Well, they did that, right? You want to, if that language hasn't changed, it's going to be a really good signal that person isn't rehabilitated to the point where they're going to be safe returning to the community under any circumstance, because that measure of control is still there. It's a tricky question. The Supreme Court's spoken on the issue. They've taken the science into consideration. It certainly makes sense to me, but it's hard to imagine someone who's committed such a brutal killing will do enough rehabilitation to make people feel safe with them in the community. So my guess is, you know, no, unless there was some really stunning turnaround, I can't imagine wanting to agree to a parole. But you really do have to look at the case and say, what have they done with the time that they've been given? Have they made significant progress? And maybe they have. You know, I mean, that's really incumbent upon the person to earn parole. It's not something that is promised. It is just a possibility.
Is there anything else about this case that really stood out to you that you want to discuss before we head off for the night?
admittedly, I wish I'd read more of the trial excerpts because I think it was a fascinating case. But Howard Whitehead was a very, very good prosecutor, went on to be a very good judge. I think you'll see now those issues of juvenile parole really playing out over the next few years. You'll see that review process be pretty lengthy. But I think we covered it.
Alrighty. Well, thank you for joining me today. And we look forward to having you on the podcast again in the future.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on the Evil Within podcast. Next week, we will continue discussing the Amy Carnevale case, but this time we will get more into the details of the case, as well as the tragic aftermath for the family, as well as the town of Beverly, Massachusetts. Once again, thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you again next week. Stay safe.